And so I thought we might back up and take another running start at this outline on Corinthians and see how far we can get tonight. Hopefully we can get done with the outline. And so remember, before we start doing this, one of the assignments was to learn as much about Corinth as you can. And we did some pretty good stuff last week. Who remembers some of the stuff that we said about Corinth last week? The nearest seaport on the eastern side is Cenchrea. Now there's another seaport that's on the western side that is also very near. If you look at the strip of land, does anybody have maps in the back of your Bible? Yeah, open it up to the one that has Paul's missionary journeys on it, because that's the best one that you're going to see there. And if you look, you'll see they don't have the western seaport mentioned. But you'll see Cenchrea and Corinth are right next to each other there on the little isthmus. Everybody knows what an isthmus is, right? Okay, so with these two seaports there, one of the things that they used to do in Corinth was the ships would come in and offload their stuff, and they'd take it by land over to the other seaport and then load it on another ship. Or if the ships were small enough, they'd actually transfer the ships by road. It's about 3.5 miles wide at this point. And it made it a very critical thing because for the ship to go all the way down around the Cape, especially during the winter time, was extremely dangerous. And so that's one of the reasons why Corinth became such a thriving metropolis, is it was situated strategically here for commerce. Actually, the city was destroyed in 44 B.C. by Julius Caesar, and then the same year he began to rebuild it. And he rebuilt Corinth with freedmen, that was people who had been slaves and had been given their freedom, and with veterans from his army, people who were had served the army long enough that he was willing to let them go, and with a few of the people that still remain there. And they enjoyed kind of a Roman type of government. They had the people could vote, and they had a council, and they had magistrates, and it was kind of like a mini Rome in the style of government they had. And this contributes greatly to a lot of the culture that they had in Corinth. The Corinthian culture was closer to the Roman culture than it was to the Greek culture. And so this is one of the things. So because it was so strategically located, it flourished, and people got wealthy there. I mean, this was a place where you could make your fortune. And so, as people do when they start becoming prosperous, they started turning to other things to consume their thoughts and their interest. And one of the main things that they did is very much like what people do today, particularly people who don't believe in the Lord, is they seek after status. Now, how many ways today can you think of that people try to attain status? Come on. Cars, homes, politics, wealth, power. Power, wealth, education, all of those things are status. Philosophy, one of the things that the Corinthian people liked to do was to espouse the latest philosophy and to come along and to learn whatever the latest philosophy was that the people were, or that the usually Greek, but sometimes other nationality philosophers were, and to really understand that so they could discuss that and so they could be more of an expert on that than their neighbor was, you see. And this is, you know, Pastor James mentioned this morning, he mentioned 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, and this is kind of what Paul is referring to when he says, how did he come into Corinth? Okay, when we get to the outline, you know, the first thing is on division in the church. And a part of that division stemmed on the wisdom issue. There were people that were saying, well, you know, I'm of Apollos because I think he is a better speaker than Paul is. I'm of Apollos because I think he's got more elegant She's got more elegant arguments. He has a higher status in this. He's wiser than Paul. And some of them even got so that they were not just preferring Apollos, but they were actually opposing Paul. And so when Paul comes to him with his argument, he says, I determined to come among you not with the wisdom of words, to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ be made of no effect. And that he says that in chapter 1, and then in chapter 2, he continues the same thought, the first couple of three verses of chapter 2 there in 1 Corinthians. He says, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. So Paul's main point was not that he couldn't be a great teacher. It's not that he didn't know the stuff. It's not that he couldn't put forth a good argument. If you read his epistles, you can see the man has a mind. I mean, he can really espouse and lay down a logical argument. But when he came to teach to him, he didn't want the focus to be on himself. He didn't want the focus to be on his teaching, on what a great guy he was. He wanted the focus to be on Jesus Christ. And so when he came with a very simple message, and a message that would be an affront to those to the people in their current way of thinking. So in a lot of ways, Corinth was a lot like the postmodern era that we live in today. There's a lot of people that are seeking for status. And there's a lot of people that take the practical approach. How many times in your life have you heard the phrase, the bottom line? Well, the bottom line is, or this guy gets to the bottom line, or we hire this guy because he's going to give us a better bottom line, you know, or whatever. The bottom line, the effect has become all important. And Paul says, no, that's not what I came to preach. I didn't come to preach anything about a bottom line. I came to preach about Jesus Christ. And I guess you could sort of paraphrase that if you wanted to and say the bottom line is Jesus Christ. But that would kind of defeat the real thought of it. He wanted to get away from the bottom line type of preaching. And so that's kind of the backdrop that we come into here on the letter to Corinth. Now, we also spoke last week, we talked about the first part of the book of 1 Corinthians is what Paul has addressed his problems that he has been informed of by Chloe's people. And you'll see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 11. Okay, he says, for I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you. And that starts the first thing. So we're going to get into that. Now, how do we know, in the outline that I handed you that was preceded, how do we know that Roman numeral 2, or 3 it is in this outline as I have it there, starts a new section? Paul responds to questions that the Corinthians have asked him. How do we know that? Well, turn to chapter 7 in 1 Corinthians and read the first part of the first verse. What does the first part of the first verse of Corinthians chapter 7 say? Now, concerning things about which you wrote. Okay, so the whole first segment is, this is what I've been informed of by Chloe's people. That there's some problems in the church, and we're going to get to that in a minute. And the second part is, now concerning things about which you wrote. And he kind of continues that. What's the first part of the first verse of chapter 8 say? Now concerning, or now about. Your translation may have now about. Now about this, now about that. And you'll find this phrase, and that's the easiest way to outline and say, okay, he's gone on to a different topic here. It's not 100% accurate. There's a time or two where he says, now I would not have you be ignorant, brethren, or now I would not have you to be uninformed, or something like that. But quite frequently throughout here, you'll find that he says, now about this, and now about that. And they all follow that now concerning the things about which you wrote. And so it's like, okay, he's got a letter here with a list of questions, and he's taken them presumably in the order that they're written in the letter, and he's just answering them. So that's how we get the two main divisions in the body part. Now, we said last week that the Roman numeral 1 was the... let me get the blue one. I think it's easier to see than the green one. Roman numeral 1 was the Greek epistolar, the formal stuff, the things that make it a letter, right? So I'm going to put epistle form up here. And I'll just mention those briefly. I'm not going to write them on the board. You have them on your paper. You have the author. You have the recipient. You have greetings. And we talked about last week how he co-opted the word for greetings and changed it to grace. You know, you can almost do that in English. Greetings starts with G-R. Grace starts with G-R. You know, so that's kind of what he did, although in Greek, the word is a lot closer. The word for greetings and the word for grace is a lot closer than it is even in English. And then you have the Thanksgiving prayer or Thanksgiving wish, which is present in nearly all of the Pauline apostles. Do you remember which one doesn't have the Thanksgiving prayer or the Thanksgiving wish? That's the apostle to the Galatians. Man, he wipes into those Galatians right off. You know, he does Paul an apostle to the church at Galatia, grace and peace, and you idiots, how could you possibly think this? You know, I mean, he just wipes right into him. He skips that Thanksgiving prayer or wish and all that and just wipes into the Galatians because they have what? Distorted the gospel. They've been sucked in by the Judaizers. They bought into what the Judaizers are trying to tell them about how to become a Christian. And he lights into them. And he does not do a Thanksgiving prayer or wish in that epistle. Okay. But if you look at the rest of all of the Pauline epistles, you'll find that that form is there. That's the way they all start. And not even the Pauline ones. Most of the other epistles have at least some of the elements that are epistolary in form there. So you have the epistle form things, and then you have the body, and for us that's Roman numerals 2 and 3. And now I'm going to say that in most of the Pauline epistles, you won't find it as neatly categorized as it is here in 1 Corinthians. We have these huge clues in 1 Corinthians as to how this outline goes. We have the dimension of the issues that Chloe's people tell him about in verse 11 there, and then you saw in chapter 7, he said, now concerning things that you have written about, you know, so that divides it there. In most of his epistles, the body is one long argument which addresses the central problem, the occasion. Remember, we said that epistles are occasional documents. That doesn't mean they're every now and then. It means there is some occasion that caused them to be written. And so usually the body portion is a fairly lengthy argument or discussion or case or reason or defense of his position where he advises them on whatever the occasion was that caused them to write it. But in the case of 1 Corinthians here, there are a lot of things, a lot of problems that he's writing about. So the first one, this is problems he has been informed about. And if I write that big, I've got my 3 way too close here, so let me... Okay, and I filled in the first one for you, the A, which is the divisions in the church. And that's chapter 1, begins with what, verse 10, is it? Chapters 1, 10 through the end of chapter 4, whatever the last verse of chapter 4 is. You know, sometimes the people that did the the chapters and verses did okay where they put the chapter divisions, and sometimes they didn't. By the way, do you remember from a long time back which was the first Bible that had the chapter and verses in them? Okay, go back and listen to session one. No, you don't have to do that. It was the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was the first one that we had, and it's about 1560, if I remember correctly, was the first one that had the chapter and verse divisions, and it's the same ones that we have today. Okay, so anyhow, he's talking about divisions in the church. 421 is what I have on my paper. Now, when you look at this, you'll say, well, he seems to diverge from that quite a bit in the middle here. He seems to be talking about wisdom and all this other stuff, but all that is part of the main part of his argument. He says, I know why you're having these arguments about these divisions, and a lot of it has to do with your notion of wisdom. And then he comes along, and if you read it, it's really kind of entertaining, because he says, you know, we're not dealing with earthly wisdom, and you know, if they were, if God were looking for wise people, would he have picked you to be his church? I mean, that's one of his arguments that he says in there. He's, you know, if he's looking for people that are wise, would he have picked all of you people to be his church? and there's some other arguments. And then he flips it in and says, but we are talking about wisdom. We're just talking about God's concept of wisdom, not man's concept of wisdom. And so all throughout here, he's still building the case for why there should not be divisions in the church. Okay? And as a matter of fact, in chapter 3, he even mentions the divisions again, or he mentions Apollos in 3 verse 5. He says, what then is Apollos and what is Paul? And he goes on to give a couple of analogies. He gives an agricultural analogy, and then he gives a construction analogy for how they're all only part of it and God owns it all. Okay? That they have different tasks, that Paul plants and Apollos waters, that's the agricultural thing, but God's the one that gives the increase. Or that one of them lays the foundation and the other one builds on the foundation, but the building is God's. And so all of this thing about wisdom that's in there is all part of the same topic that he's addressing here, and that's the topic of divisions. Now, we get a new topic at the beginning of chapter 5, and what is the topic? What is the second topic that he talks about here? It's a little bit more specific than that. He talks about the incestuous man. This is a specific case that he talks about in chapter 5. So I'm just going to put incestuous man and that's 5:1 to whatever the end of chapter 5 is. Yes. Yeah.
With his father's wife.
His father's wife. Yeah.
Did they believe that the
biological related? We don't know. Most people take that to be his father's second or third wife, with a broader definition of incest than what we have today, okay? It clearly was an immoral situation. It was something that should not be. And it was a problem that was so bad that Paul said, this guy ought to be churched. Okay? I mean, I'm kind of going to... I'll condense it for you, okay? that was what he taught there. And I'm not going to go into that anymore. We'll just go on to the next topic. C, verses 1 through 11 of chapter 6, deals with what? Lawsuits. That's exactly right. Lawsuits. And what does he say about lawsuits?
We shouldn't be suing.
That we should not take our brothers in Christ before a civil court. Now, again, you have to kind of feed this back into what you know of the Corinthian culture. Remember that in Corinth, that because of all this great commerce, it became quite a place, and one of the major industries was providing meeting places for people to have business meetings and to make their deals and all of that. And matter of fact, there were whole big buildings that were built just for that purpose, because this was the crossroads. This is where people from all nations came and met. Okay, and so it, because you had all of these different cultures mixing, they had to have a lot of magistrates to solve some of the issues, the business deals that were going on. Okay, and so the people were quite used to, just as in our society today, do it at the drop of a hat. Well, let's take this before the magistrate and get him to settle it. And Paul says, you know, this isn't a secular business world. This is the church. And you're not to do that kind of thing in the church. First of all, you need to have some attitudes of selflessness here. And if you really do have a problem, you need to take it before the body. Okay, but that whole deal there is that whole topic there is on lawsuits. And again, I take it that that is one of the things that Chloe's people have informed him about, because we haven't got to that section yet where he says things that you wrote about. And then finally, the last part of chapter 6, verses 12 to 20, now he talks about sexual immorality in general, not just the specific case that he addressed in chapter 5, but he talks about sexual immorality in general. So there we have it. We have the first part of the body, and we've divided up the first six chapters of 1 Corinthians here. We've got four main topics. And now when we go to study it, we can take one of those and break it down into its contingent parts, you know. But we've got a logical frame that we can hang our study on. So now the next part, and there's no way that I can possibly get it on the board, so I'm going to erase Roman numerals 1 and 2, and we'll start with Roman numeral 3, which is the the problems that that they wrote him about. Okay? So bear with me just a minute here while I erase. I could tell you the joke about the guy that dug up Beethoven's corpse, and when he opened the coffin, there was a little man in there, and he was just erasing the music as fast as he could. And he'd erase a page and flip it and erase another page. And he said, "Well, who are you?" The guy that dug him up. He said, "Well, I'm Beethoven." He said, "Well, what are you doing there?" He said, "I'm decomposing." All right, so that was just a spill while I erased, you know. So. All right, so Roman numeral 3 is issues that the Corinthian people have written him about. And so the first one of those is in chapter 7. And what is that? What is the first one? What is the first issue? Marriage. It's advice about marriage, okay? Okay, and I say in the outline that I seated for you that that's chapter 7, verses 1 to 24. Now, some of you may think that this chapters 25 to 40 continues on in marriage, and it might. But there's a new term that creeps up in verse 25, and that term is virgins. Okay? And so we're just going to say at this point that it's about virgins. 7:25 to 40. Okay, and commentaries come up with two or three different possibilities for what virgin means. And even translators do. If you look in some of the different translations, someone will say his virgin daughter. Okay? And some of them will not say that. And it is unclear to a lot of people whether he's talking about a man that has a good friend who is a female, who is a virgin, that he's contemplating marriage and it fits just in the marriage context, or whether he's talking about a man who has a virgin daughter and fails to give him in marriage or withholds her, will not give her in marriage to somebody else, or wonders if he should withhold her. And you got to back up a little bit to the Paul's stuff on that he says on marriage. And what is one of the things that he lets you know when he's discussing marriage up here? What does he say in verse 12? Somebody read chapter 7, verse 12. Okay, that's enough. I just wanted to get that first part, Cameron. What he says is, to the rest I say, and I say, not the Lord. So he's telling you right here in the letter that this part of the letter doesn't come from God. This is not the word of the Lord. This is just my personal opinion, okay? And it's my personal opinion, and I'm telling you this. And James is looking at me strange, and I'll let him rebut that at some other time. But later on he says something, now this I say, and this does come from the Lord. So you have to look at that in a couple of different ways. One of the things that he says in this chapter, he says that he wishes that all people should remain as he is. Well, how is he? Unmarried. How is he? Always a bachelor? Had he ever been married? Connie, you're nodding. What do you think?
I don't know very much, but I think so.
We don't have any specific scriptural evidence that says Paul was married. But we do have scriptural evidence that say that he was being considered to become a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay? In the stoning of Stephen. Remember, he was up there. And one of the requirements of the Sanhedrin is that a person be married. And so, implicitly, and we have to go back to the difference between implicit and explicit, we cannot say categorically, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that he was married, but I sort of think he was. And furthermore, what I think, and this is me, this doesn't come from the Lord, what I think is that when he became a Christian, that his wife left him. That she was riding his star. He was going to be a member of the Sanhedrin. He was going to be somebody. And when he became a Christian, she said, I don't want any part of that. And that she left him. And so he is now unmarried, whatever the legal status was, whether she divorced him. And again, we don't even know for certain that he ever was married, but at the present time, he is at least unmarried. And so, you know, if you look at that when you're reading this, you know, he says to those who are unmarried, let them remain so, or all of that. And then he does that kind of thing. So then the next thing on virgins, I don't really want to do anything with that tonight. We may do that at some later date. So let's move on to what's the next topic.
Frank.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think when he wrote that, he was single. Okay? And I think that if he had been married, it would have been before this. Okay? I don't think, judging from what I read here, at least his mindset was that he wasn't ever going to get married again. Sure, he does later when he gets to a little section there that's on liberty, right? Okay, which is actually contained in this next section. So what's the next broader section? And, well, you know it's got to be somewhere starting in chapter 8. What's the topic that we take up in chapter 8? Meat offered to idols. You know what? I don't want to write that whole thing. I'm just going to write meat/idols. And that's 8-1. So how far does that go? Well, one thing you could look for is you could look for the next time when he says now about or now concerning. All right. But in this case, that would trip you up because I think it goes through 11:1. And 11:2 doesn't have the magic phrase now about, although it does have now, at least in my translation. Okay, so I think this goes from 8:1 to 11:1. Now, he does an excursus. Does everybody know what that big word means? Excursus? Exactly. He chases the rabbit. Or he does a side topic, or he comes across a topic while he's teaching this that he feels like needs to be expounded, and so it looks like he's gone away from the topic, but it's only temporary. He does a temporary change away from the exact topic of meat offered to idols to talk about liberty, to talk about the liberty that he has as a Christian. And basically, he says, all things are lawful for me. In other words, I have the liberty to do just about anything I want to. Not all things are expedient. In other words, there are some things I probably shouldn't do, and there are some reasons why I shouldn't do those. So he has this excursus on personal liberty, and in that excursus is where he talks about what James said, do I not have the right to a believing wife? Do I not have the right to be paid for ministering to you? Do not all the apostles have the right to sustenance? They're sustaining you in spiritual matters. Do they not have the right to be sustained in physical matters by you? And yet Paul did not take advantage of this right when he was in Corinth. Does anybody know what the only church that we know of that Paul accepted support from? The Philippians, exactly right. He accepted support from Philippi. But he did not accept support, as far as we know, from any of these other churches, and we know that he did not from Corinth. We know that he took a job as a tent maker while he was there, and he worked for his own sustenance while he was there in Corinth. Not that he had to. And so when he gets to this excursus on personal liberty, he talks about a lot of those topics, and he says, I have a right to do this, and I have a right to do that, and I can do all of this stuff without really hurting my Christian witness, but I didn't. And the reason I didn't is because I did not want you to misconstrue anything. I didn't want you to think that I was in this just for the money. In other words, I wanted to point you to Jesus Christ and to Him alone. That's what that's Paul's underlying thing of all of this. All right. He does also say, a little bit earlier, we've already gone past that passage, but he says, you know, I fed you with milk because you weren't ready for the meat. You know. the author of Hebrews also says a similar thing there in chapters 5 and 6 about I wish we could talk about more things, but maybe you're not quite ready for that yet. But at any rate, this whole thing is about meat offered to idols, and there's basically two sub-issues that he addresses, and see, we're only doing this level of outline. We're not going to the 1, 2, 3s under that tonight. We could do that at some other point. But what are the two ways of meat offered to idols that he discusses? Did you catch that when you were reading it? One of them is if you go to the marketplace and they have it for sale and they say, we got meat offered to idols, and you say, I don't care, I'll take it, you know. You have the liberty to do that. The other one is that they say, why don't you come with us to this feast here where we're going to honor this idol and have a good meal while we're doing it? And he says, you can't do that. You can't do that kind, because to do that kind, you would be identifying with them and their culture instead of identifying with Christ. So some would say he's ambivalent on meat offered to idols, but what he's trying to get apart is it's not the meat. That's not the problem. It's the context. And it's what are you displaying if you partake of this? And if you just buy it off the marketplace and take it home and eat it, you're not displaying anything. It's just meat. Because we know that there's no such thing as idols. You know? But if you go to the celebration, the feast, where that meat is offered to the idol as part of that celebration, then you're participating in that celebration. And you shouldn't do that. Okay, so he addresses it in two ways, and in the middle he has this thing on his personal liberty. We're getting there. We're going to get done tonight. I feel it. Okay, so then we have, that goes to 11:1. What begins in 11:2? This is one of the passages that I like to do a lot about. It is public worship, but it's even more it's narrower than that. Okay, all of chapter 11 does have to do with public worship, but we're going to divide that into two things: women's head coverings, right? Okay, so that's 11:2 through what verse does that end? 16. Okay. Okay. Boy, this is an interesting passage. I really like to do with this passage. There's a lot of things in this passage that you deal with. And when we start talking about what Sproul calls principle and culture, and what Fee calls, well, maybe there is principle and application, and culture is a different thing. So Fee and Sproul do not use the word principle in the same way. But when we get to that discussion, which is the chapter 5 discussion, we're gonna talk about this some more. Some of the things that I'll just give you a preview. Some of the things that you need to note in here is that a lot of people today tend to use this to say, well, Paul was just a misogynist. You know, he was just anti-feminist. He was trying to beat women down. But if you look at this passage, it doesn't really support that. Because he says, women, when they pray and when they prophesy in public worship, then they need to cover their heads. Well, the implication is that women were allowed to pray and prophesy in public worship, right? Now, the real issue that he's addressing is there is a distinction in the sexes, and you need to preserve the distinction of the sexes, and also the principle, Fee would say that the underlying principle is that when you're praying or when you're prophesying, you don't want to do anything to call attention to yourself, you want to call attention to God, because that's who you're praying to or that's who you're prophesying about. So that's what Fee would say is the underlying principle, and that this particular application was that. James, you were...
I have a question. In the synagogues during that time period, were females allowed to speak?
In the synagogues?
Yes.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think so.
Because, you know, you hear Miriam prophesizing, you hear Deborah prophesizing, but you don't hear anything other than that. And so, in some respects, John was a radical feminist, or Paul was a radical feminist in that... He said, yeah, we're going to have women.
Well, Christ was. I mean, if you go through Luke and you go in chapter 4 and 5 and he talks about the ministering women that kind of went along. You know, most of the other Gospels just talk about the 12, but Luke tells us about the women that kind of went along with it too. So the whole Christian thing was light years ahead of the way women had been treated prior to Christianity. Okay? And so we'll talk about that in another context here. Just in a few minutes, we'll bring this back up. Because one of the principles, if you have your yellow sheet from the that has the chapter 5 stuff on it, I don't have very many questions for you on chapter 5, because we're going to have a lot of discussion. Just hold that a minute. We'll get to that. Okay, so the first part is about women's head coverings. Particularly when they're praying or prophesying in public worship. Now the next part is what? The next part of chapter 11 talks about what? The abuse of the Lord's Supper, right?
And that's 11:17 to 34.
Okay. Okay, and you can read that, and it's pretty obvious what was happening there. One of my commentaries had a couple of pages on describing some of the buildings back then, and so they had the main dining room, which they'd put the couches in, and the Corinthians reclined to eat and all of that. Then they'd have a little antechamber that was maybe the same size, but didn't have the couches, and so you'd get, you know, 12, 15 people in the main dining room with the couches, and 40 or 50 people into the crammed into the second room, and the people that were reclining at the couches, they get all the good stuff. They get the choicest food and drink and all of that, and kind of the leftovers filtered out to the other deal. Now, I don't know if that was specifically what was Paul was addressing here, but it was something like that. Okay, so you had some people that were going there, and they were hogging all the best portions and getting there early to eat, you know, and they were using the Lord's Supper as a meal to satisfy their physical things, and not using it the way we use it in a symbolic fashion and in community and joining in community and in a corporate worship sense. Okay, and so that's what the second part of chapter 11 is about. Now, what begins in chapter 12? Spiritual gifts. And it goes all the way through what chapter? Right. Spiritual gifts goes from 12:1 to 14, was it 40? Yeah. Okay. And you'll notice that right in the middle of this we have 1 Corinthians 13, which is the great love chapter, which probably you've heard at weddings more times than you can count, you know, though I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love. And the emphasis in that context is this is what love is. This is what love is. But see, in the context of what Paul wrote it, you have to back up to the last verse of chapter 12. What does the last verse of chapter 12 say?
Eagerly desire the greater gift.
No, 12. That's not 12. That's is it 12? And now I still show you a more excellent way. Yeah, the last half of it. The last half of the last verse is he says, I'm going to show you a better way. What's better than all this arguing over all of the spiritual gifts that you have? And a huge portion of this thing was about speaking in tongues. Okay, that was appeared to be the most contentious gift. And if you look, Paul kind of ranks that down at the bottom. All right, when he does this list of gifts, you know, he does pastors first. That's the best gift, right? The gift of prophecy first, and then teaching, knowledge, and wisdom, and et cetera. And he gets on down, and finally, he does speaking in tongues at the very bottom of the pile. Okay, but it's one of the most visible ones. And you see, when you're looking for status, like the people in Corinth were, well, you know, you can see that I can babble in tongues. You know, that I've got this spiritual gift. I'll tell you just a little. When my son was, I don't know, 5 or 6 or something, he came up and asked my wife. He said, Mama, what does corbanda basai mean? And she looked at him and said, what? And it turns out that he'd gone to watch Transformers, which came on at a certain time of day, and you know the Transformers, the cars that turned into robots and vice versa, and all of that was. Well, right before that, Robert Chilton came on the TV. It was one of those seed faith preachers. It was always, you know, you pay your vow $1,000, and I'll see that God returns it to you tenfold. And he'd come on and he'd do tongues, but you see, he did tongues so much the same way and used the same words that my 5-year-old kid picked up on it and learned them. Learned his tongues vocabulary. So, I'm not going to say anything really against speaking in tongues, except be careful, there are an awful lot of counterfeit tongue speakers out there. So that's what these people were arguing about. And so that love chapter coming in the middle of that says, hey, look, You're arguing about this spiritual gift and that spiritual gift and your status and all that, and you're missing the point. You're missing the whole point. The whole point is to be filled with the love of Christ. And if you're filled with the love of Christ, these are some of its characteristics. And he sits there and enumerates those in chapter 13. So that chapter 13 needs to fit in that context. Not that you can't pull it out. I'm not saying that you can't use it in a wedding ceremony and that it's not appropriate. It is. It's beautiful, and you can. But when you're studying the Scripture to find out why was this communicated, how was it communicated, you need to put it back into its context. Okay? And an interesting thing here, at the other thing that I'm going to mention is at the nearly the end of chapter 14, verses 34 and 35. And I would like for Elena to read those verses for me.
Women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church.
Okay. All right, so I kind of did this tongue-in-cheek. You got to ask yourself, what is that doing in the middle of this passage about spiritual gifts and speaking in tongues? What's it doing there? It doesn't really fit there, does it? And it doesn't so much that some of the scribes and some of the manuscripts moved it down to the end of the chapter. And in some of the Latin manuscripts, they actually kind of footnoted out and said, don't use this in the liturgy. Okay? All right? And so the textual critics say, well, you know, it was there. It was there in Paul's letter. It was there in the original, so we're going to put it in there. But this raises a lot of things. Now, I'm going to call your attention to the yellow sheet. And I want you to look down at the bottom at C's principles. And what does principle number 3 that C has say on this yellow sheet? You have your yellow sheets?
Note where the New Testament has a uniform and consistent witness and where it reflects differences.
Okay, note where the New Testament has a uniform and consistent witness and where it reflects differences. Now, what did this passage that Elena just read say? Women should be silent in the church. It's particularly talking about worship here. What did we find out in chapter 7 about women's head coverings? That they should have their heads covered when they pray and when they prophesy. And so, you cannot say that this is a uniform and consistent witness. Alright? If you take the immediate interpretation of chapter 14, verses 34 and 35, that means that women cannot talk in the church. Okay? That's what it appears to say. That is the most straightforward literal interpretation. And yet, we see that in his very same letter, just 7 chapters earlier, he has implicitly given permission for women to pray and prophesy in the church. And so it can't mean that. And so I'm not going to talk about what it does mean right now because that's we don't have enough time. But that's just one of those examples where you have to look and use that principle that C has about where the Bible has a uniform and consistent witness and where it does not. Okay, and then continuing on, we're about to get through with this outline here. What begins chapter 15? The resurrection. And it's all of 15. 15, 1 to 50 something. How many verses in chapter 15? 58. Okay, this has become of late one of my favorite chapters because I think it illustrates, well, when you see people attacking the resurrection, and you'll spend a lot of time in this chapter. And Paul's argument is very lucid. You know, if If Christ be not raised from the dead, then we are of all men most miserable, because we're preaching a lie. Okay? And our sins are not forgiven. And we're not any better off than people who aren't saved. Eternally speaking, you know. If the resurrection didn't happen, then we don't have any hope. Okay? Now, there's also the verse in here, and I've quipped this before, you may have heard me quip this before, there's also the verse in here that authorizes church nurseries. And which verse is that? That is verse 51, yes. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. All right, and we laugh about that because, you know, we kind of take it out of context and say, well, that's talking about the nursery babies. They're not all going to go to sleep, but they're every one of them going to have their diaper changed. But this verse is a real sticking point because you have to parse that. And I'm not going to go in and show you what the Greek is. Several people told me that you don't like it when I do that, so I'm not going to do that. But what I'm going to tell you is that in Greek, the negation goes with the verb, as does the person. In other words, the verb ending, it's kind of like in Spanish, you don't always have to have the subject or the pronoun. You can just have the verb, and the verb ending implies he or her. Right? With the verb. Well, it's the same thing in Greek, and so the verb here implies we. You know, yeah, like vominos, you know. You don't have a separate word that has we with it. You know, it's let us go is built into the verb form, and it's the same thing in Greek. And so it's we shall sleep, because this is a future. And then the negation, the negative particle, negates the verb. So it's we shall not sleep. And then the adjective or substantive, pontos, which means all, is there. And so it's only those three words. That's this we shall not all sleep is all, not, we shall sleep. Okay? And so when you parse that and when you go to explain that, the translators have done part of the job for you. Okay? Because is it we shall all not sleep, or is it not all of us shall sleep? You see, either one of those translations would be correct from the Greek, grammatically. Okay? And so the translators have said, well, it can't be we shall all not sleep because they died. You know, first of all, the sleep is obviously a euphemism for death. Begs the question, who's the we? Is Paul talking about himself and the members of Corinth? If it is, then Paul just made a mistake. Because he and all the members of the Church of Corinth are undoubtedly dead by now. Beg your pardon? Well, we don't know that, but we can reasonably assume that, okay? We can reasonably assume that. And so, if Paul made a mistake, then how did that happen under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit? Is the Bible inerrant? Okay. And so you know, this can be a real sticking point verse, and you need to take it apart, and we're not going to do that tonight, because we only have about another minute or two to finish this, and so we're going to finish this outline tonight, so that next time, we don't meet next week because it's first Sunday and probably not Easter Sunday evening either. And so it'll be the third week of April when we come back. Okay, so we've got to do F here, which is about what? Oh, yeah. Sorry, you know my alphabet, yeah. H, and I think there's an I also. All right, so H is about what? Begins in chapter 16. It's about the collection, isn't it? When does he start chapter 16? Now about the collection. All right. So chapter 16 said about the collection. In 16:1-11, I think. And then he says now about again in verse 12, right? Or but concerning Apollos, okay? And so it's the return of Apollos. And that's only that one verse, 16:12. And then he kind of segues from that into the personal remarks and the final thing, which is the end of the Greek epistle form. So you see that what we've done here is we now have a pretty good hook, a pretty good handle of the rough first level outline of the book of 1 Corinthians. We know what's in there. We know it's in two main sections. We know it's got the formal stuff at the beginning and the personal stuff at the end. We know the first part is about things that Chloe's people told them about, and the second part is about things that they wrote about themselves. And we even have a handle on what those individual things at least grossly were. And we haven't dived into them yet and picked it, but we've got a pretty good working outline here of the book of 1 Corinthians. And we've also seen some of the principles from the fee thing about culture, although we haven't solidified that yet. So that's all the time that we have for tonight.